And welcome to episode. What number is this? Is this 8?
I have no idea.
Welcome to the next episode.
I think it's eight.
Welcome to a podcast that we do kind of every week, usually. Is that better?
And we're happy about it. We like doing it.
It's been a lot of fun with Jason Parks. I'm Mike Farron, and we had a chance to meet a lot of people who listen to the podcast. A lot of BP readers this weekend in Seattle, and it was great fun hanging out with them.
Absolutely, man. I mean, the events keep getting better and better. The fans are, they keep showing up smarter. You know, they're like these as you said off the air. It's like they're these well-rounded fans that, you know, it's not just numbers anymore. I mean, these people show up and, you know, they know the numbers. They can marry them with the scouting. They have a lot of varied interests. And then, you know, we usually go out and have drinks afterwards. And everybody seems to enjoy each other's company. And it's a cool group, man. I like doing these things a lot. I mean, a lot of interesting people, people that I end up hanging out with later on, people that I, you know, start to call friends. It's cool.
Yeah, no, and it was so much fun just being in Seattle with all the listeners and the readers, and, you know, watching them react, watching the questions that they ask. You know, first of all, Jack Cirencic, the GM of the Mariners, literally brought his whole baseball operations department.
Yeah, they brought a crew.
I mean, it was outside of their amateur scouting director and their farm director and their pro scouting director, who were all out doing, you know, I mean, well, the scouting directors were out doing coverage for the draft. I mean, he had his numbers guys, he had his advanced video guys, he had his assistant general manager Jeff Kingston with him, and they all answered the questions. And I thought as impressive as Jack was, and I thought he was pretty candid with just about everything that he said.
Sure, yeah.
That the questions that he got were fantastic questions. I mean, none of them were accusatory in tone. None of them were like long, rambling ones that you get at a fan festival where people are just trying to hear themselves talk or they're getting nervous. They were pretty direct questions. And I thought that the group did a great job of asking, you know, in the 45 minutes that they spoke, a lot of really important, relevant questions, not just to the present, but to the future of the Mariners.
Yeah, and like the only thing that was really missing is that nobody asked him why he was wearing a tracksuit.
Because he's a scout.
Right, but he was wearing a tracksuit. So, I mean, I kind of wanted it addressed, and I definitely want it out there. Because it was pretty awesome.
So, I mean, I think it's a generational thing, right? I mean, you know, the Jack's from the generation of scouts and basketball coaches that wear the tracksuit, whereas the younger generation is a little bit more Joseph A. Bank.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I would say yeah. Brooks Brothers, but I know they can't afford it.
Yeah, so. they wouldn't go in there.
So, but it was cool. What was your biggest takeaway from what the Mariners front office said?
You know, and I kind of want to go into this a little bit later on in the segment after the emails, but it was the, you know, when people were asking them about some of their failures or, you know, or perceived failures or, you know, current failures with guys like Montero and Ackley and Smoke, and them not shying away from the fact that they haven't played well, both as a team, and they haven't played well with the prospects developing into quality, you know, dependable major leaguers. And I thought that the way that he addressed that and the way that the rest of the staff addressed that, even after the fact in private conversation, it was very candid and it was very honest, and that, you know, they really weren't up there doing a sales job as much as they were just talking about their team.
Yeah, I mean, I like that, too. I like that, you know, he didn't mention Sean Figgins by name because I don't think he wanted to embarrass the player, but he put that on him, too. I mean, he acknowledged the mistakes they've made. He said, listen, you know, you may not want to hear it because the results haven't been there, but our organization is healthy. You know, he talked about how important that was. He talked about their decisions on why they're making decisions on their young pitching and why they don't want to rush guys, you know, and, you know, pointing out very quickly how young Taiwan Walker is, and that's why he's in AA, and why it's different, you know, the reasons why there are differences between him and the Michael Pineda situation. And I thought all of that was really, really interesting. I thought there was some of the sausages made stuff, too, about how their advanced scouting report guys go in and present the information to the manager, Eric Wedge, and to his staff as they get ready for a series. And I think, I mean, first of all, I think the fact that they do most of their advanced scouting on video, I mean, I think that we can certainly have a discussion about that as to whether or not that's a good idea. But the fact that they bring it in, when they bring it in, and giving people an understanding of how advanced scouting works with what the staff needs to know, I thought was a great part of it as well, because you got a sense of, you know, how they're presenting the information to the staff to help make the players make the best decisions.
Right, and for me, that's the whole event. I mean, it's it's one thing that, you know, to see us up on stage, ask us some questions. We can be silly. We can talk for a little bit. And then, you know, we get to talk to these people afterwards at the game, maybe after the game at a bar, having some drinks or whatever. But, you know, watching the Mariners front office pull back the curtain and provide us with, you know, the way they go about looking at things, some of their process and stuff. That's, for me, that's the event. I mean, that's what I would pay money to see.
Right. And that's what I love hearing anyway. I mean, I'm tired of listening to us talk already.
Sure. I hate this show.
Speaking of those events, the next one is June 15th at Turner Field. Go to baseballperspectives.com to buy your tickets now. You will be there.
Absolutely.
So, and then after that, July 7th at Nationals Park, and I hear ticket sales are robust for that. So if you're going to be in D.C. and you want to go, you better buy your tickets now.
Yeah, that'll sell out.
That's going to be a lot of people there.
Yes.
So
varsity team's coming.
You're letting me play with the varsity. That's awfully nice.
Well. Yes, of course.
So, all right. We will get into all of the normal stuff we do. I should mention that you can always follow the Fringe Average podcast at Fringe Average on Twitter. You can be part of our Facebook group, which is facebook.com/groups/Fringe Average podcast. Jason's Twitter handle is at Professor Parks. Mine is Mike Farron SXM, which stands for Sirius XM. And if you'd like to buy a subscription, it'll help to keep me employed. Music this week comes from a band called Wolf Face.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited about this.
Are you?
Yeah, very much so.
Did you listen to some of their stuff before the...
No, I wanted it to be a surprise when I actually listened to the podcast for the first time.
When are you going to listen to the podcast?
I want to hear this band.
That's the whole reason why you're going to listen. They just got signed.
Yes. Hell yeah, I want to hear this. Like, somebody told me about it on Twitter, and it's like, yeah, this sounds fantastic.
So let me read their bio from their Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/pubesonmyface. I'm assuming that that's going to be the tune we'll play at the end. In the mid-80s, young Michael J. Fox, like most teenagers, went through some serious changes. However, the changes Michael faced were unlike any other teenagers experienced. Where other teenagers were dealing with pimples and getting erections in public, Michael was dealing with fangs, hair, and claws. These changes brought both fame and ridicule to Michael. With the help of his father and his close friends Boof and Styles, Michael overcame the many unexpected challenges associated with being a teenage werewolf. Skip ahead. Today, frustrated by the vapid music bombarding all aspects of the music scene and the absurd romanticizing of werewolves in shitty books and movies, Michael has decided to hit the road again with Wolf Face. Michael J. has re-released the original Wolf Face self-titled cassette on digital technology. This could be obtained online for free, or you can grab a CD at the Wolf Face shows. And the record label Mooster Records in Chicago has signed them to do an all-new album coming up. So it is a punk band that is based on Teen Wolf.
That's awesome. That's awesome in every way.
So we'll send the link out, and I'm a little bit of a punk guy. It's fun. It's going on the iPod. I'll tell you that much. So, or iPhone. I guess I don't have current technology. So, all right. So let's go ahead and dive in on the emails. Then the first one comes from Mike in Connecticut, and he says, "Dearest Jason and Matt."
Matt. That's a good
By the way, my favorite Facebook comment on the event was, gee, it was really great to get kicked in the back by Mark's nephew the whole time.
Yeah.
I'm watching Jose Altuve at bat right now, and I can't help but think, sweet fuck, this guy has a tiny strike zone. I would hate to pitch to him. And it got me to thinking about past discussions of players like Altuve or Dustin Pedroia, how their diminutive size hurts them in the draft and free agency. Why wouldn't it help them? Isn't it harder to throw them a strike than ogres like Richie Sexton or Corey Hart? I think if the tools are there, and they certainly were for Altuve and Pedroia, then shorter players would be prized based on the fact that there is less real estate in the strike zone with which the pitcher can work. What do you guys think? Cove for life, Mike.
Well, there's certainly a scouting bias against the smaller players. It's not universal, of course. It depends on the player and depends on the person doing the evaluating. But I've been guilty of that. I mean, I've looked at somebody who's not a prototypical size, and strength. And I think that the strength component is a big part of it. When you see a guy who's very, you know, diminutive, you wonder about whether they can turn the ball around. You know, you wonder whether they can, you know, play 162 games at the major league level and be able to hit for some sort of power and not just be slappy. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, you look at a guy like Altuve, it was a great story. I thought it was awesome when he was hitting in the minors. And at no point did I think that he was going to become an above-average hitter at the major league level. And I'm not trying to knock Altuve. He's just a dwarf. You know, he's a very small person. And I didn't think that he was going to be able to do it. And so I discounted him to a fault, you know. And that looks bad on me, but I didn't see it, you know. I often don't see it with the smaller players.
There were a lot of people that missed on Pedroia, too. I mean, sure. I think the numbers community was higher on Pedroia because of the walk rate than were kind of the more traditional scouting community. But, you know, the guy swings from his ass. He swings hard, and he's got great plate coverage and really great balance. And the thing that they both have in common, Altuve and Pedroia, outside of their height, is that they have incredible work ethics. And I think that's one of the things that kind of gets lost in this with Altuve is – this guy has worked his tail off to be a good hitter. It's always nice when your best player is your hardest worker, and that's been the case in both Boston and Houston. And I'm not saying that that's ingrained in, you know, every short player, but, you know, there are some guys when you may not have the tools or you may be somebody who's likely to be overlooked, I think that you've got to play harder. You've got to work harder. David Eckstein was another example of that. I mean, we like to call guys like that grinders or whatever, but there is something about you know, having to make sure that you get noticed when you're not at eye level with everybody else.
Right. I mean, I think that one of the reasons these type of players are referred to as gamers or grinders or grit guys is because, you know, obviously that's what they have to do. But, you know, they also possess they're strong. They have to be strong fundamentally. You know, they have to work twice as hard, as you said. But, and I think that one of the things I tried to learn from guys like this is that, you know, if you see a player that has, you know, baseball skills, you know, not just the raw tools, but like, you know, actual skills that they can bring it onto the field, they can make it work. And they do so with athleticism, but with also for instincts for the game, which is a big thing, you know. And when it comes to hitting, it's such a, you know, an instinctual thing to do that, you know, you shouldn't discount it. A hitter's hit, and these guys always hit. And I thought that because they were small, they weren't going to continue to hit. But you know, it's a relatively simple act. These guys just can do it. They just hit.
Yeah, I almost think that there's, you know, well Mike points out in the email, you know, Richie Sexton and Corey Hart. I mean, you don't see a whole lot of 6'6", 6'7". I mean, what was Sexton? Was almost 6'10", right? You don't see guys that size that are hitters because the idea is, well, there's a long swing. It takes them forever to get to the ball. That there's more 6'5", you know, 6'6" guys than there certainly are, you know, 5'6", 5'7" guys. But I don't know if it's necessarily a bias against them, but there's certainly a lot more that can go wrong. That not all of them have a short swing like Nate Freiman does. There's a lot of length that I think people see. Well, you know, we may discount this guy because he can be exploited at the higher levels.
Sure, I mean, I see that, but when I see like a guy like Sexton or Hart, I think about leverage. I think about what the opportunity mm-hmm. that leverage can create. You know, I think it creates such a high ceiling as opposed to the other guys who really have to. They have to overplay, you know, they have to go above and beyond what the tool based ceiling is, you know, to have impact potential. And I look at a guy like Sexton, you know, he could run into 30 plus bombs just because he's got that kind of swing. He's got that kind of strength. And, you know, that's sexier for me. And as I said, you know, the Altuve Pedroia types, they really teach you a lot about scouting and how not to put players in boxes all the time.
Our next question comes from Randall, and it says, "Hello. I just listened to the latest episode of Fringe Average. It was excellent as always. The beer story time reminded me of one of my favorite beer stories that also happens to involve baseball. Many years ago, my hometown received a franchise in the Independent Continental Baseball League. It was barely minor league baseball, and we have had some very good amateur talent grow up here recently, Michael Wacha, Slade Heathcott, John Stilson, and others. But it was still cool to have minor league baseball in my backyard. Now to the beer part. The team was unable to serve beer the first season of its existence, but secured the proper licensing for its second year. I was excited for the first Thirsty Thursday game of the year and gathered some buddies and headed to the ballpark. I went to the concession stand and ordered a couple of the generic beers offered. The guy then asked if I wanted a can or draft. Of course, I said draft, and watched as the guy poured a can of beer into a plastic cup and hand me my draft beer. I laughed and headed back to my seat. I then sent my buddies to the concession to get their draft beers. We laughed for many innings. Not as sentimental as the professor's story, but I still smile to this day thinking about my draft beer at the ballpark. Thanks, Randall. That's good stuff.
I like canned beer. I like beer in a can.
I like beer in a can. I like beer on draft better, but I like canned beer.
Yeah.
I drink a lot of cheap canned beer. There's some nice ones that are available now in just cans.
Sure.
There's one, a great one in Baltimore called Resurrection that's from Brewer's Art that's really good, that's only available in cans or the big – they do them like jugs at the place, or the 750s too. But
you can get 6-point in cans. It's good.
There's a – what's the one that's – is it Church Key? Is that the one that you actually have to have an old church key to open, like pop tops on both sides?
Well, that would make sense based on the name of the beer, but I have no idea.
The name of it, I think it's Church Key. It's absolute garbage. I mean, it's so shitty, I won't even drink it. Our next email comes from Garrett in Dayton. Dear Mike and Jason, my question is in regards to Mark Appel and how his signing will go down this year. It seems as if everyone thinks he'll be selected either first or second this year. With that, he obviously is slated to make more than he would have as the number 8 pick last year, even without the slot as high as the Pirates could go without penalty. That said, without the leverage of going back to Stanford, could we possibly see the Astros or Cubs offer him less money than the slot? I assume he could go play independent ball for a year and re-enter the draft, but would he want to spend another year not having the big league bonus or starting a service time window? I assume the drawback to this is the backlash from the fan base and having one less top prospect in the organization. One last absurd question. If the Astros or Cubs see Appel as a low-ceiling, high-floor prospect, do you lowball with the thought of gaining the second or third pick in next year's draft? Show's awesome. Thanks for all you do. Garrett in Dayton, Ohio. Some great questions on the draft.
It is, and you know, I was disappointed that he didn't sign last year because I'm a big fan of, you know, get into the professional system, get into the developmental system, and you know, work your way to the major leagues. If you're good, you know, your money will be there. You know, and I would be really pissed off. I would be really disappointed if there was a similar situation this year and he ended up going to independent ball.
I mean, I think if he went to independent ball, don't you have to question the guy's desire to go and play ball? I mean,
I questioned that last year.
Yeah, I didn't really, because he's still getting a Stanford education. You know, I mean, if he were at our
Does he want to be a pitcher, or does he want to be a college student?
Does he want to have a fallback?
You could, okay. I mean, then he doesn't believe in himself. That bothers me.
I mean, he's definitely got. He's definitely played his cards to the point where he's going to make more money. I mean, I don't. You know, there's a little buzz of late that he may not be in the top two.
I mean, I think the money's going to be there if you're good enough. You know, get into the system, get up to the majors, show your rig, and then your money will come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're, you know, look, if I'm going one or two in the draft, I don't look at that as a top of the rotation characteristic. That's just me personally. I don't like that type of, you know, I understand that he's got to get money while he can get money. I understand the Stanford fallback. I understand that. We're talking about a guy who could possibly go 1-1, you know, 1-2. And if you think that he's got a first round a top of the rotation valuation or projection, which I personally don't, but if you do, I want to see the characteristic of, you know, I'm a bad motherfucker and I'm ready to get into pro baseball and show people. My money will be there because I'm awesome.
Come on, he's not the first player who's been a top of a rotation guy that's gone, fuck you, pay me. He's just done it as an amateur. I mean, I think that there, I think if you want to, yeah, you may not like it, but it, I don't think it changes, that in itself doesn't change, you know, who he is or can be as a pitcher. I don't think whether he, you know, ends up reaching his ceiling or not, that's necessarily it. Now, listen, I mean, if there are issues with, you know, you're concerned how competitive he is on the mound, or if there's concerned about, you know, whether or not he can rise to the occasion, any of that in game, you know, and I'm not saying that that's the case with Appel, but if that's something, then yes, I can see it, you know, if that's coupled with what's going on, you know, financially. But if you feel like this guy is a competitive guy, if you feel like he's somebody who, you know, who has that kind of dick gene that makes him a good number one pitcher, then what does it matter? I mean, what does it matter in the end? I mean, that to me, just in not taking the money, isn't enough in the evaluation to really ding the guy on the surface.
It bothers me, and I'm dinging him for it.
Okay. All right. So now the next question is, without the leverage, or let me see, what if you're one of the teams like the Astros or Cubs and you see him as the low-ceiling, high-floor guy? Do you lowball him with the thought that you're going to get the number two or number three pick next year?
I mean, that's the interesting part to me, more so than, you know, anything else. I mean, this draft is kind of – I mean, I think next year's crop is going to be – it's going to be a better draft next year. But, like, just looking at it right now, I mean – you know, we obviously we've talked to a lot of organizations. There's a lot of rumor going on out there. I mean, as you said, there is a chance that he's not taken in the first couple of picks. You know, because there's not a clear number one guy right now, at least in my opinion, at least the people I've talked to, knowing that the Astros have several players on the on their list. You know, I don't know. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's risky to try and do that. I mean,
I think it's very risky.
I think you want to get the player in your system. Listen, Pittsburgh didn't take him last year thinking they weren't going to be able to sign him. They took him because he was a great value at the number eight pick, you know, and they wanted to sign him. They wanted to you know, bolster their system. And imagine if they had, you know.
I know.
We can talk all we want about how weak a draft class looks a year out or how strong it looks. You know, maybe this draft class isn't quite as strong as last year's, but I think it's stronger now than we thought it was a year ago, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, of course.
So, you know, maybe next year's there are injuries at the top or the lack of performance that makes what looks like a strong draft class.
Yeah, there's just too many unknowns.
You've got to deal with the variables you can. If you take that guy, you sign him. You know, if you're going to take somebody with that number two or number three pick, you want somebody who's a lottery ticket. You want somebody who's got a chance to turn into a stud. You don't want to take the risk of saying, well, maybe I'll be able to do it next year. Maybe we'll get somebody even better, because maybe you won't. And there's too much uncertainty with the player development track as it is. So I think it's way too risky to go into it thinking, you know what, this guy's a senior, we'll lowball him. And I think what we've seen with his agent, you know, Scott Boras is his advisor. If Scott Boras has a track record of being able to take guys to independent ball and then get them more money the next year. And I think that's, you know, just because you're going to write him off and say, well, you know, if he's not going to take our offer, take it or leave it, he's gone, doesn't mean that somebody else isn't going to pay him another year from now, or doesn't mean that Scott Boras isn't going to find a loophole that's going to allow him to become a free agent or something. I mean, who knows? I mean, that would scare me as a team, too, knowing that, you know, not only may I draft this guy, but he may end up someplace else and end up being that guy, or there may be, you know, there could be unintended consequences by not making this move, because we're still early enough in the CBA that I guarantee you there's a loophole that none of us have found yet.
Right. Well, and Boras scares me anyway, because you think that, oh, like, we have some leverage on this guy because he lacks leverage because he's a senior. Now, Boras has leverage built in all different kinds of places. He shows up with leverage.
Who would you
Boras
take?
Will, who would I take?
Who would you take 1-1?
Man, that's tough. Gray scares me.
Because of the hard landing leg?
The stiff landing leg is one thing, but also, you know, pop-up velocity guys kind of scare me. I've got a couple of reports on his overall approach to pitching, which kind of scares me just a little bit. Again, when it comes to the 1-1 guys, I am really looking for, you know, a killer. You know, Bryant, maybe?
That's who I'd take.
I think that'd be the safer bet for me.
Yeah, but I also think that there's ceiling there. And in a game where there's literally no power... Now, I mean, how do you pass up that guy?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, the arms are – everybody's got a little a question mark here. And, you know, I like some of the high school crop too, you know. I mean, I like Frazier. I think that Frazier's going to be an insane hitter.
Let's talk about that for a second, because we got an email on it last week and we didn't get to read it. But talking about, you know, Baseball America had on the cover – to talk about the bias against, like, the little redheaded kid, right? And, you know, Clint Frazier is a high school outfielder from Georgia who's, what, 5'10", maybe? Again, this goes back to the little hitters, right? Little guy, crazy bat speed, probably has a left field profile, and he happens to be the little redheaded kid, and there aren't a whole lot of little redheaded kids that have played professional baseball. I mean, I don't know. Is there an inherent bias against it, or if it's a kind of situational bias because it hasn't happened before? There are teams that are scared of Clint Frazier because they because he's 5'10" and a redheaded kid.
Yeah, I mean, it's always fun to make fun of gingers. But I think, I mean,
can the ginger play?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it comes down to what you see in the person. If do you think that he is? I'll put it this way: like, do you believe in the bat? And like, I've heard some reports about like some of the exit velocity coming off of his bat, and apparently, it's pretty special. If you think he has innate bat-to-ball ability, you know, obviously he's, you know, he's got five-tool potential. I'm not 100% convinced that it's going to be a left field profiler, though it probably will. But if he hits, which is the carrying tool here, if he's a bad hitter, like a badass hitter, and you think he's going to be a badass hitter in the like in the mold of like a Yelich type of badass hitter, like a grade seven hit tool, you know, it's not an ideal profile. But if he's going to be that, and you really believe that he's going to hit, take the hitter, take the guy who's going to hit. I wouldn't care if he's a ginger. I mean, I'd make fun of it just because it's funny, but I wouldn't take a player because he was a ginger.
Okay, so would you take Clint Frazier 1-1 in this draft?
I would not.
Because he's a ginger?
No, not because he's a ginger. I just don't. I mean, it's because of the risk reward. I mean, I think that I like taking the risk, but I mean, his risk is more extreme than Bryant.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's what you're going to find down the stretch. I mean, the Cubs have been linked to Bryant lately. You know, I know the Astros have been talking about Bryant. Man, the guy hit
30. They like him.
They like him a lot. And you know what? You're talking about a guy who hit 31 home runs with wet newspapers in a ballpark that doesn't – you know, he's playing at University of San Diego, which has some of the same weather conditions that Petco Park has, where the ball doesn't travel at night. They play a lot of night games on the West Coast Conference. There's a lot more big ballparks out west. You know, some of the best teams in the West in college – I mean, UCLA, I think, is hitting like 250 as a team, and that's one of the best teams out there. Part of it is just the area of the country that kind of suppresses offense because they're in these – they're not in like the desert of the California League. So it's a – I mean, he's a really intriguing guy because of that power and because there's still a chance he could be a third baseman. And if not, he could definitely play left field because he's got a strong arm. And he could play first base in the end and have the power to stay there. I really think he's intriguing because I'm not sure what Appel's ceiling is. I'm not sure that he's necessarily a number one. I think he's got number one stuff, but I don't know that he's necessarily a number one.
Yeah, I haven't talked to anybody who thinks that he's a number one. I mean, I think that he's going to be a very good major league starting pitcher.
What's his ceiling?
2-3.
So the question is, and what's Gray's ceiling?
1.
Okay. So if you're looking for the pitcher, then Jonathan Gray's the guy you go for.
Unless you think he's a reliever.
There's
which some people have mentioned. I mean, Appel's a starting pitcher at the major league level, and it's not going to take him long in the minors. If he falls into your lap, you go for it. I get that, but you know, Gray's got the higher ceiling. He's got the superior raw stuff. I mean, but he's, you know, is he mostly fastball slider? You have to worry about the landing. Is he a guy that is his pop up velocity sustainable? How does he, you know, with some of the approach questions, does he actually know how to pitch his way out of situations? Mm-hmm. You know, is this a guy that can pitch once the velocity starts to go down, which it will? You know, what happens when he gets into a pro system? I mean, there's a lot of things to look at when it comes to Gray, and if you don't draft a reliever that high.
Well, but then again, you have to – I mean, there have been relievers drafted that high. It's you have to not think that he's going to be a reliever when you draft him.
Well, no, yeah, that's the
thing. It's not like you're taking a guy who's a seventh inning and eighth inning guy. It's not like you're taking – you know, a couple of years ago when they had the first rounders out of Arizona that were all relievers. There were relievers in college, you know.
Right.
I mean, shit, even college relievers. I mean, Andrew Cashner was a reliever in college. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily fine. If you're taking him 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, you're developing him as a starting pitcher.
You would hope so. That's the thing. I mean, and obviously a team that would do that would feel that he is a starter and not one of the minority opinions that believe that he is a reliever. I have a couple sources that, you know, they think that he's a long-term reliever. But, you know, it's also – it's easy to put a guy in the reliever box. We talked about this before.
Yeah. Well, we got an email on that. In fact, you know what? I'm going to read that now about putting guys in the reliever box.
Yeah.
I got to get, because it's out of order here. But the next email comes to us from Tommy. And here's his question. He said, I saw a Jim Callis tweet a month or so ago when Carlos Martinez was promoted about how teams are too quick to put Latin American pitchers in the bullpen. He didn't really expand on that thought, nor did he think that Martinez was being permanently shuffled off to the pen. He's since been set down to work on being a starter again. But I've been wondering about that tweet a lot lately and about just how often Latin American pitchers get turned into relievers based in part on their ethnicity. I did some of the most basic research possible and found that only 12% of starters in 2012 were from Latin America, while 21% of relievers were from Latin America, and 27% of all MLB players are Latino. I can't find data on what percentage of those are Latin American-born Latinos, though. My question for you guys is this. Why? Is this a case of poor pitcher development for Latin American kids before they sign? How much of that could be due to the smaller body frames found in Latin America? I could only get data on Venezuela, Colombia, and Mexico, where the average adult male is 3 inches shorter in the U.S. My searchers also found a bunch of reports on malnutrition amongst kids in the Dominican Republic, so I can't imagine that the average height there is greater than in the U.S., but I can't say that with any certainty whatsoever. Do the shorter average frames also kind of sort of explain part of why so many middle infield prospects come from Latin America? Is it just that there aren't a lot of Latin American arms developing as hoped in the minors right now? Michael Yanoa is probably the most visible sample of the big-time J2 signing having all sorts of problems. Is it a more sinister problem? Scouts and organizations making decisions heavily based on the ethnicity of the player. Going through old scouting reports of players in the awesome Diamond Mines website that the Hall of Fame set up, which is phenomenal, there are other often racial comments on the cards of Black and Latin American players from many decades ago, so I imagine it's possible there are remaining vestiges of a more racist time in the sport's history. If it's a racial issue, are there any other parts of the game where racism, racial bias is still prevalent in decision-making situations or just in the day-to-day life of the minors? Very interested to hear what you have to say on this. Regards, Tommy.
I've thought about this a lot. I talk to people about this all the time. And I think it, you know, obviously it's got to be player-specific. You got to look at what's going on and where they're from. But, you know, I've noticed a lot of Dominican pitchers end up in the bullpen, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, there aren't, you know, there's not organized baseball. You know, these are showcase kids. These are kids who they learn how to impress people with certain things from a very young age without the benefit of pitching. With pitching, I mean, most of these guys are throwers, and they learn how to showcase throw. You know, they know how to put their certain talents on display so that they shine and so that they can get picked up out of the water. You know, in Venezuela, where there's Little League, you know, you see a lot more feel for pitching. You see a lot more team ability. And this is true for position players, too. You know, there's a more, you know, there's often more instincts. There's often more connection to the game. There's more fundamental skill. And so when you get Dominican pitchers that come up, they often lack the third pitch. They often lack feel. Now, it's obviously not, it shouldn't be blanket. You know, you have to look at the individual. But there is a large number of Dominican pitchers that just don't develop into starting pitchers. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they don't know how to pitch. You know, they know how to throw. And it's hard to learn that, you know. And sometimes it just doesn't work. It doesn't click, you know. There's a lot of other reasons. There's a lot of, you know, socioeconomic reasons as well. And when you look at kids coming out of Venezuela, there's, you know, there's more money. There's often more stability. There's better education system. And there's structured baseball from a very early age. And I think that plays a big role in the development long term. So, I mean, it's not really a surprise to see more, you know, Latin American pitchers, especially Dominican pitchers, end up in the bullpen. Looking back 20 years of scouting reports for racist comments doesn't really do anything for me. I mean, I think that you're going to find that in all walks of life. I don't really see a lot of racist bias in the scouting process, or at least the people that I talk to nowadays. I mean, I'm sure if you look back 20 years, you're going to find all kinds of stuff. I think that, you know, we've taken steps forward in that regard, but unless you consider what I'm saying to be in that racist box, which I don't, I just happen to, that's the way I believe, and that's what people I've spoken to also believe.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really good point. And, you know, the one thing that I would say, just in terms of if there are racial issues, and not necessarily in day-to-day life or anything like that, but there has long been a dearth of African-American starting pitchers as well, mm-hmm. or African-American pitchers. And, you know, I know we're focused on you know, the commissioner creating a council on diversity and trying to find, you know, ways to make the game more accessible in traditional African American areas. I had a scout that I was talking to a couple of weeks ago about this, saying, you know, this isn't a black white issue. He said this is a rich poor issue, because that showcase baseball that you're talking about in the Dominican Republic is also what, you know, it kind of permeates in American culture now, and it's very expensive to play travel baseball. I mean,
absolutely. That's a big thing. That's a great point.
And I thought he was so spot on with it. And he was telling me about this story about, you know, he lives in Tampa, and one of the big schools there, he'd run into a college coach somewhere, and they were having a conversation, and he was talking about the facilities at this big high school in Tampa. And he's like, "Have you ever been over there?" And he's like, "No." He's like, "But you got like three players from there." He's like, "No, I just go to the showcases and I pick them up there. I don't have to go there. It saves time and money for the coaches. It's easier for them to try and recruit in that regard." You know, there's a lot of benefits to the showcase. I mean, we're both involved in, you know, stuff with Perfect Game. They sponsor the BP mm-hmm. show on XM on Sunday nights, and I love what Perfect Game does. I love the opportunities that it gives to kids to showcase and all of that. But the other side of it is that when you're playing in these showcases and showcase tournaments, it's a little bit different than playing the game all the way around. And I think I wonder if that's going to impact not just, you know, what you're talking about in the way, you know, specifically kids in the Dominican Republic are noticed, but the way all players are noticed, or if it's starting to impact the way all players are noticed now.
Right. I mean, and I wrote a little bit about this in the Baseball Prospectus Extra Innings book, about mm-hmm. how, you know, showcase baseball is a wonderful thing. You know, it's awesome to go scout those things. It's awesome to have all those people in the same field facing talent, which is something you always want to see, which is something you don't often see at the amateur ranks, especially high school. But at the same time, you know, you're not getting, you know, we're losing a little bit of fundamental play in that regard. You know, you have guys who are built for showcase talent and not built for the game of baseball. They have a ton of tools and they like to show them off, but they don't always have a lot of game skills. You know, they can't often hit in games. They can't often make the plays in game. And, but they have strong arm. You know, in the Dominican Republic, when I was down there watching the showcases, you know, it's like cattle. You know, you run them, you put a number on them, you're looking at certain attributes, and then you watch them throw from the outfield, you watch them throw from shortstop. And here's what's really funny is that a lot of the shortstops, they were running up on the ball like 10 feet and basically throwing it like a javelin. You know, and it's like, what is that really telling you? I want to see a guy set his feet and make the throw, not put his entire body into it and basically pull an X-dime with every single throw, most of which weren't even hitting the target.
Right.
You know, and I know at that age you're looking at the raw skills that you can then develop and mold into the player that you think that they can become, or that the tool-based ceiling suggests is possible. But when you do that, you lose sight of what is actually important in the game of baseball, which is, you know, feel for the game and the ability to develop skills for the game, not just the raw tools. The raw tools guys are the ones who flame out more than anybody else.
That's what I was going to say, is that you know, how many of those guys that have that raw tool or those raw tools end up actually making it with no baseball instinct? I mean, how many guys do you see in the major leagues that have, like, zero instinct for playing the game of baseball?
I mean, that's the thing, is that you don't see very many, and the ones that you do see, you know, the guys, it's there a little bit, or they have such extreme, like, hand-eye coordination that they can just kind of make it work. Like, I had one scout tell me, and it's like, you can probably speak on this or disagree with it, but he was like, you know what, he's like, I used to sit on Sammy Sosa, both when he was an amateur and then when he first came up in the minors and then when he was in the majors, and he was like, the guy doesn't have a ton of baseball feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's got such impressive, like, hand-eye coordination, and just, you know, his wrists and his hands are so fast and so quick, and, you know, his body is just kind of built for athleticism, that he made it work without being, like, a superior, you know, instincts guy or a feel guy or a skills guy. And, you know, you see guys like that, but they have to be extreme. They have to have, like, you know, attributes that are off the chart in order to make it. I mean, if not, the raw tool guys without the instincts just don't develop into much, because they hit that wall in Double A, and if they have the athleticism to push past that, they never really develop to their ceiling, because they don't have that feel that helps bridge the raw tools into baseball skills, which is ultimately what you want to do with a player.
Well, I think too, I mean, you know, you mentioned in Sosa's case specifically, you know, one of the big adaptations that he made as a hitter was in working with Jeff Pentland. And he gave Pentland a lot of credit for helping him develop an approach. And I think that that's kind of where the nature of coaching can come in. If you're dealing with players that do not have fundamental skills, that do not have instinct for the game, focus on one aspect of it to try and teach them. You know, for Sosa, it was trying to create some level of plate discipline, which was never great, but he certainly got a selective enough that, you know, he was posting 400 on base percentages, and his best years he was hitting over 300. You know, you can say whatever you want to about, you know, how he got to those numbers or what you think the influence of, you know, if there was any outside influence, and if so, how much impact it had. You know, you can talk all about that that you want, but the fact is the guy still had to create some semblance of an approach at the plate, and he took to coaching. It takes some guys, you know, to a long time to find someone who can communicate it properly to them. And for whatever reason, Jeff Pentland could do that. The two hitters that he worked with that always gave him the ton of credit were Barry Bonds, because Bonds played for him at Arizona State, and Sosa.
Well, and that's a good point, because there's a truck going by.
No, that's okay. I got a dog that needs to be fed too. He's driving me fucking nuts.
But anyway, so I think that's a really interesting point, because, you know, we often talk about how talent is talent is talent, and everything's about talent, and it's about getting talent, and then it almost seems like we're putting the coaches and developmental staff and you know, we're not giving them enough credit. We're diminishing their accomplishments. But this is a perfect example of a player that, you know, you isolate what you think he can do well at the highest level and what can have an impact, and you try to coerce that. You know, you try to extract that from the skill set. I think that's vital, and that's where the developmental staff and coaching really, really shines.
All right, our next email comes from Patrick, and it says, first of all, holy shit, from a couple weeks ago. Jason, do you really have a Mellotron? Like a Mellotron, like with tape inside and everything?
No.
Okay.
I have a Mellotron patch, just like I have an Optagon patch and those kind of things. I mean, I'd love to have a Mellotron. That'd be fucking awesome. I wish I don't have one. No, unfortunately not. It's just a patch.
Second, my question, which I've been wondering about for a while, is if I, as a 30-year-old man, woke up tomorrow to find myself the best player in the world, the best baseball player in the world, would I be able to ascend to the major leagues before age-related decline sapped all of my newfound ability? The actual mechanism behind my transformation is unimportant. Chemical, supernatural, and elaborate rookie-of-the-year-style surgery gone wrong, whatever. But as someone entirely outside of organized baseball, would there be enough time left in the life cycle of my hypothetical talent to be discovered and to progress through the ranks eventually to the major league level? This question is really just an unnecessarily elaborate way of getting at several things about the scouting and development process. As such, there are a couple additional optional detail questions that may or may not warrant specific consideration. Would the specific profile of my hypothetical greatness affect the likelihood of being discovered and believed in? I assume the equation changes if I'm a pitcher, where it would be easier to scout something like 470 to 80 grade pitches, but I guess the question is, would certain major league quality tools catch scouts' attention outside of advanced competition levels where others would be dismissed? Would the physical profile matter? Might I get noticed at 6'2", 145, but dismissed as unlikely to succeed at higher levels, whereas at 6'2", and a trim 170, I'd be penciled into a major league lineup by September? How much of a track record would it take to be believed in? Am I doomed never to make the big leagues because I wasn't already good in high school? Whether or not you guys answer this, thanks. I've enjoyed the podcast. That's Patrick from the St. Paul Public Library. Yeah. He fixed the DVDs at the St. Paul Public Library. That's pretty awesome.
I mean, I don't really know how to answer the question other than to say, like, obviously, yeah, it would be easier if you were a pitcher. And regardless of size, if you're showing like 480 grade pitches, somebody's eventually going to notice. You know, someone's going to notice the velocity immediately. Someone's going to notice whatever. Now, whether they believe you, you know, obviously it's going to take time to get you against better competition, and then you'll have to prove it every step of the way. Now, as far as being a 30-year-old that just all of a sudden becomes an amazing hitter, I'd love to see that, because I just don't think it's possible.
Well, I mean, if you woke up and all of a sudden you had, like, superhuman strength or superhuman eyesight or something like that, I mean, I suppose you could, but you're still going to need time with pitch recognition, right? I mean, that's going to be the biggest thing is adapting to that, and it's probably going to take you at least a couple of years. You know, the one thing you have going for you is you have maturity, right? And one of the issues that you have in the minor leagues is guys, you know, have a lack of maturity. If you've got an idea that you can quickly process, you know, the differences in what makes a good approach as opposed to what, you know, a 17 or 18 year old has, and you're kind of a blank slate, you're good with coaching, then maybe you could move relatively quickly in that. You know, I mean, it's very rare that hitters get signed out of tryout camps. Every once in a while you see a pitcher get signed, but if you show up at, you know, well, let's say the Colorado Rockies are having a tryout camp on Thursday at Coors Field, and you show up there, you have to really show them. I would think you'd have to show them power more than anything in order to be signed, because it's really difficult to try and determine what the hit tool is based on taking batting practice, you know, what's in essence batting practice at a tryout camp.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you're a hitter and you go to a tryout camp and you hit bomb after bomb after bomb and they decide to sign you based on those bombs, and then you're in the minor league system and they put you in at a lower level and just to see what they have there, and you continue to hit bombs, well, then they will continue to move you up, and then you will continue to prove yourself at each level until you reach the major leagues, and it becomes a feel-good story, and then they make a movie about it, and the movie's pretty good.
You become Evan Gaddis. You become Evan Gaddis, basically.
Right.
Evan Gaddis is Rookie of the Year.
Right.
So
I didn't think he was going to hit at the major league level.
Boy, is he good.
Yeah, he really is.
I mean, I wonder how much of it is matchups, and I wonder how much of it is just, I mean, one of the things that they talked about.
Texas power.
Fuck you and your Texas power. God damn it, I'm so tired of your fucking Texas shit. It's so fucking annoying. You have no idea. I fucking worked with a Texan on Monday, and all I heard about was how great Texas was. I just wanted to, and he's from real Texas. He's not even from Dallas.
What's real Texas? What are you, Kendall?
South of Dallas. Oh, no, Jason, I can't. You're from Oklahoma.
That's Kendall, yeah. Except, you know, not country enough.
I didn't
completed a sentence.
I didn't put on my dad hat.
You weren't wearing dad jeans and a Aggie class ring.
I think though too that physically, if you're that good, it doesn't matter whether you're 6'2", 145 or 6'2", 170. If you're showing up at a tryout camp or whatever, and they notice you, you know they're going to notice what you're doing. If you have an 80 fastball, I don't care if you're 4'7", they're going to sign you. So.
That'd be pretty cool, though.
That would be awesome. That's Tim Collins. Well, he doesn't have an 8 fastball, but, I mean, yeah, Collins was, I mean, basically that guy, wasn't he out of a tryout game? He was an unsigned guy, yeah. Undrafted high school free agent.
Yep, and it was like, hey, take a look at this guy, take a look at this guy, and then.
Yeah, if I remember right, didn't he go to J.P. Riccardi's high school or something like that? I mean, that's.
Maybe. He's
that's
little.
Like how he got noticed. He is wee, yes. Our next email comes from Bryce and says, gentlemen of Fringe Average, with the recent demotion of Oswaldo Arcia to AAA Rochester, I have to ask, why the fuck? Disclaimer, I'm not a prominent user of curse words, but my first email to you guys didn't contain any and didn't get read. So hopefully by dropping a four-letter word or two, maybe it'll get read this time. My thoughts as a fan of the Minnesota Twins. Yeah. Way to fucking go. My thoughts are, as a fan of the Minnesota Twins, is this the team is going nowhere in 2013 and likely 2014, and the team should use those 2 years as trials on who's part of the future and who's not. And the trial should not last 30 games and 107 plate appearances. It was getting obvious that he had troubles against anything other than a fastball, but this leads to my question. As a batter that's being demoted, how is he expected to work on hitting major league off-speed and breaking balls when the guys down in AAA aren't doing it at that level? I would imagine as a pitcher, you could have him work on command, control, pitch effectiveness, and sequence, and all that can be done at any level. But as a batter, if your main struggle is hitting good non-fastball pitches, and you're facing primarily fastballs and inferior breaking pitches, how does one improve? The manager can't force the opposing pitcher to throw off-speed pitches. You just have to get what's thrown at you. As a Twins fan, I'd prefer to see him getting his lumps in this year and next, working on hitting those pitches and gain confidence against major league pitching, not false confidence against minor league pitching. Continue the great fucking work, Bryce in Minneapolis. Can I just give the kind of clerical definition of what happened with Arcia?
Sure, yeah.
This was, I think, as much about roster flexibility as anything. It was, he's a guy with options, and they kind of had to make the move. He had gotten off to a really good start, slowed down of late, and they're trying to figure out what they have in Chris Parmalee, too, who's a little further along, and they have to make a decision on Parmalee because there's a good chance that Morneau's not back next year. So there's a couple of different options that have to go into this, in addition to the fact that they were, you know, bumping pitchers around and around trying to find starters because they had to bring Dodduno up. They ended up having to send Worley out. And I know, you know, P.J. Walters took one of those spots, and they moved some guys around. They ended up waiving Joe Benson. But I think that most of this had to do with procedures and less than with, you know, their unhappiness with the way he was performing at the big league level. I know Ron Gardenhire really likes him. We didn't get a chance to talk about it because we had Gardy on our show today. I didn't get a chance to talk to him about Arcia specifically. But that was my sense in just kind of reading the tea leaves and what happened, that this was less about Arcia and more about what they had to do roster-wise.
Good, that makes sense, because if you send him down to AAA and it's, you know, you can send him down there and you could see them working on like maybe a mechanical issue, or maybe it's a confidence issue. They want him to go down there and just get back into the feel of raking so that they can then bring him back up to the major leagues and he'll be more comfortable and confident. But, you know, to this point, Bryce's point, you know, yeah, we've talked about this before, and I agree that, you know, you can't really simulate the major leagues and the minors. And if he's hitting fastballs and struggling against major league stuff, then I think that he needs to see a lot of major league stuff, especially when you're on a team like the Twins, where if you're going to be a part of the future, you might as well take your lumps now. But your explanation makes a lot more sense. And, you know, from a developmental standpoint, it's not the worst thing in the world.
Well, and at least at AAA, you're going to see a ton of – I mean, you're not going to see –
you're going to see some junk, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to see a ton of shit. And it's just going to be – the problem is that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be mediocre, but you're going to see it in hitter's counts. I mean, I think that for a guy like Arcia who might be struggling with anything outside of the fastball, the getting that at least seeing off-speed pitches and counts when you're used to seeing fastballs is going to help your development. I really believe that. And it, you know, again, I mean, it's not like he's not going to be back at some point. You know, maybe they move Willingham. Maybe they finally decide that Parmalee isn't the answer. Heck, maybe Morneau gets hot and they move him, you know, which is a distinct possibility. Arcia is going to be back. And in the end, because we are talking about probably 2015 before they're really any good again, potentially, then the 150 plate appearances or whatever he got at AAA ain't going to hurt him. You know, it's not like you're sending out a pitcher, you know, who, you know, there might be a finite number of innings in the arm. It's not at all like that in my mind.
Well said.
We'll get more into this you know, what happens with minor leaguers and when's the right time in just a minute. So the next email comes to us from Houston. Fucking Houston. It says, Jason and Mike, big fan of the new show, loved Up and In, and was pumped to see the formation of the new show, and it has not disappointed. I always like watching Mike on the MLB Network, and I really appreciate his gratuitous use of the word fuck on the show. He really throws it in whenever possible, which is a good thing. It's okay to admit that you don't know who I am. It really is. Not that many people know who I am. So
that's not true.
That's true. There's a lot of people who have no fucking clue who I am. And it's cool. I don't mind that.
I love your show on the MLB Network, by the way.
On the MLB Network television?
Yeah, I love your show on that show.
You know I'm not on TV at all, right?
Yes, I know that.
Okay. I'm assuming that you've never actually listened to my radio show either. I do have a radio show. It's just not on TV at all.
Maybe that's just what he meant.
Yeah. No, there's a big difference between watch and listen. No, it's cool.
He knows you. He loves you.
Right. We're practically best friends. I've always liked watching you on the MLB Network. Yes, no. I wonder who can you even have it confused with? I mean,
Verducci, maybe?
Hi, I'm Brian Kenny. I'm writing this email as I pack up the U-Haul and prepare for the long move from Brooklyn to fucking Houston. This is not a move I'm pleased to make, but when I married a Texan, it was the fate I always knew was eventually in store. I am very much in the bitter phase and not ready to stop bitching about having to move to what I deem to be one of the worst cities on planet Earth. On a very positive note, I have developed a deep love of Six Point during my time I've lived in Brooklyn, and the only thing that ever stops me from buying it is that it's $12 for a four-pack, which is just kind of stupid, but it was a regular in my rotation nonetheless. Last week, while I was in Houston, I was shocked to see the Brooklyn-based beer on the shelves of a big-box supermarket, and for $8.35 a four-pack. Please explain how this beer can travel 1,800 miles from its origin and cost $1 less per can than it does in its own backyard. Unfortunately, I am still so pissed off about my move to Houston that I have found a way to spin this into a bad thing. Like, somehow it will taste much worse in the backyard of my shitty Houston tract home with more space than I need than it did the two-bedroom in-law unit that I shared with my wife, two kids, and two dogs in Brooklyn. Not to mention, I'm pretty sure they don't carry six-point resin, which has 9.1% alcohol by volume and is absolute liquid gold. I digress. I'm a San Francisco native and a huge Giant fan, and I'm wondering what you can tell me about this kid, Kick'em, who's slated to throw in place a vocal song on Tuesday. Can you tell me about his upside and limitations as a pitcher, whether you think he'll have anywhere near the success that some of our other homegrown pitchers have had in recent years? Looks like we need to fit in some fresh magic from our staff, as our aces have been inconsistent at best over the beginning stages of the year. I appreciate you reading this email, and it would be badass and quite uplifting if I heard a response while making the depressing trek to Houston, fucking Houston, over the next week. And I got to look up the name of who wrote that. Martin. Thanks, Martin, for that. What do you think about...
These are the type of people who show up at the events. I like these people. These are our people.
I love it. What do you think about Mike Kick'em?
You know, I don't want to say I don't really care because it's lazy, but he's all right. I mean, I got to see him a couple of times in camp, and, you know, I thought that he was bringing it, you know, from... You know, at least showing a plus fastball. I thought he was able to locate a couple of secondary pitches, but it wasn't really fancy. I thought, you know, based on the mechanical profile, that he might be a better fit long term in the bullpen, or maybe just a back of the rotation guy. Maybe settle in as a 4-5 as kind of a 4 is kind of his ceiling. I wasn't overly impressed with the breaking ball stuff. I don't think that it's that him and any kind of ace comment need to be in the same paragraph, even though I know that's not what you meant. I think that he could be. An up and down guy, you know, or a middle reliever at worst, and probably a back end starter at best, maybe a 4.
I mean,
it's not sexy.
Yeah, it would be what if you were to rank the pitchers in the Giants organization? Click would be first.
Yeah, he would be first, and like Blackburn.
Blackburn. Yeah, I'd forgotten about him. Stratton would probably be third.
Yeah, Stratton would be there. Augusta's an interesting guy. I remember seeing him in college. I liked him a lot. I mean, that's about it, you know.
Yeah.
Alberto Mejia is an interesting guy, but he's young.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Heston, Kick'em, guys like that. There's a couple of guys that are really going to be decent major leaguers out of that group, but it's Kick'em has a chance to contribute, and I think that that's a positive for the talent acquisition and development program. And you get a guy who can compete at the major league level in some capacity, give you a start, either work in a middle relief or eventually, like, as I said, work in the back end of a rotation. That's a win.
Yeah.
It's just not a big win. It's just not a sexy win, but it's a win.
Right. Martin, thanks for the email. I promise to give you a shout out on TV next time I'm on. The next email comes from Dave in Sacramento. Hi, Jason and Mike. Hope all is well. I'm really digging the podcast. I've been listening every week and waiting to see how it matures. So far, I think the vague sense of disinterest is what stands out to me. You guys both seem to be enjoying yourselves, sort of, but you also seem to not give much of a shit, which is a nice change of pace from up and in when Kevin, RIP, was always pretty giddy. Anyway, Mike.
He cared. He too much.
Anyway, my question's about Josh Donaldson. I don't know if either of you has had the chance to see him play much, but if you have, I'm wondering what your thoughts are. He's already been a two-win player this year, which is really insane when you consider where he came from. I never saw this guy in any prospect lists, and even now, when he's killing it, I never hear anyone talking about him. I've seen him quite a bit, and his swing looks really good to me, maybe a bit long, but he has a good approach and really fast hands. I don't know if you guys would agree with that or if you've seen enough of him to offer an opinion, but he just fascinates me. I doubt the A's even expected that he could play like this. If you would have said in 2011, when Josh Donaldson was a minor league catcher, that in 2013 he would be a better hitter than Mike Moustakas, you would have been laughed out of the industry. I'm just fascinated when things like this happen. Of course, this could all be a random variance within the small sample size, but that's why I asked the question. I wanted to get a scouting take on him. Thanks a lot for doing the podcast. I hope we get at least to 100 episodes before Jason joins Kevin in the ground. Take care. Dave in Sacramento. The backstory on Josh Donaldson is he was a catcher coming up in the Cubs system. He was part of the Rich Harden trade in 2008. I think it was July of 2008. He was a minor league catcher, didn't really have, I think he had just a cup of coffee. They moved him to third base last year. he's a really good third baseman. I mean, he played just a touch of it at Auburn, but man, he can play the shit out of third. He is really good, and I think only Miguel Cabrera has an higher OPS among American League third basemen than Donaldson right now.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I didn't see it coming. I mean, he was a guy that, you know, he converted to catcher while he was in college, and, you know, when I first saw him in the minors, I thought it was a little bit raw. Then he got a little bit better. Then you start thinking, okay, maybe this guy could be a backup someday. He had some catch and throw skills. I didn't think his arm was crazy. I just thought that he had a, you know, a strong arm, a strong enough arm. I didn't think it was some sort of crazy arm. I didn't see a lot of athleticism, especially laterally. You know, I wouldn't assume that he could have developed into a third baseman or moved back into the third base role. And I certainly didn't think that he was going to be an impact bat. I mean, I really thought he was kind of going to be a backup catcher. I mean, the thing about him is that he kind of, you know, he understands the strike zone, he understands what's a ball and a strike, and he does a good job of working himself into, you know, hitter-friendly counts. And this is something that often gets lost with when people think about approach. When you say, well, he has a good approach, it's natural to assume that that means he knows how to draw a walk, and it's not that he doesn't. Mm-hmm. But the bigger benefit from being able to have a strong approach is that you work yourself into exploitable counts where you can get, you know, a fastball maybe out over the plate that the pitcher has to groove, and that you can drive. You know, you can do some damage to the baseball, which has a lot more value than a walk. You know, so putting yourself in those situations, I think, is something that gets lost a lot. You know, and he's a guy that has a mature approach at the plate. You know, he has some swing and miss. He does have some length, but he can drive the baseball, and he is able to work himself into favorable hitting conditions, and that's ideal at the major league level. That's a big separator.
And he's got some power to all fields, and he'll use the whole field. Do you really think his swing is that long, or is it just he takes a really deep load? Like, he gets back, and the hands come way back when he loads, but then he's pretty straightforward to the ball, and he does a decent job of keeping his hands inside it.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I agree with that. I think he does. I mean, I think he does have a deep load, but he does have a clean and efficient path to the ball, and he obviously knows how to put the barrel to the ball because he's doing a great job of it, something I didn't think he was going to do, and the A's are pretty good at fucking me over when it comes to evaluation, so...
Maybe you should start listening to their guys.
Yeah, no.
Hey, they got some good baseball people in it.
Keith Lindgren. They got, no, it's not that. They got a ton of good baseball people. They're way better than me. I just like to say no.
Donaldson too. I mean, you mentioned the lateral movement. If you haven't seen him, he's got incredible range to his left too. I mean, it's not quite Machado, but man, he moves really well. He's a lot of fun to watch. He's very third base, really good in the American League this year. I mean, Cabrera, obviously, we talked a lot about him last week. And I don't know if you know this, but he's a pretty good player. But Longoria is having a good season. Machado's, you know, just had three more hits yesterday.
I mean, he's so good, man.
He's fucking incredible. But Donaldson has been, you know, he's not been quite as good as Cabrera, but it's the 8 homers. I think he's in the top 10 in the league in hitting. He's got a .400 on base percentage. And, I mean, he's been a much more consistent hitter in their lineup than Cespedes has been.
It's very impressive, yeah, and I didn't see it.
Yeah, so
did you see it at all in any way?
I mean, I never saw him really in the minors. I knew what the reports were when he was coming. You know, what I knew him most was when he was in the Cubs system, because I was still in Chicago when he was there in like 06, 07, I want to say. And they were like, yeah, we think he can hit. We think he's got, you know, they saw him as a guy. Like, they saw the power being there as being a guy that could hit, you know, maybe 18 to 20 homers. They saw him in that kind of range.
Okay.
Behind the plate, you know, if everything else stayed together. But he was kind of a level at a time guy. I mean, he's 27 now, I think, right? 27 or 28. And it's taken a while to get him. I mean, they traded him 5 fucking years ago, you know? I mean, he didn't get his first sniff. And really, you know, he broke camp with the A's last year as their opening day third baseman. It was terrible. They sent him out to Sacramento for 3 months. And since he came back in August, I mean, that's when he really got... I mean, really took off. I mean, he's, you know, I didn't see him enough in the minors to know whether or not he could get it or not, but I'd never heard that he could be a major, you know, an everyday major league player. I mean, he's pretty damn good, though. Pretty damn good.
I saw him, you know, several times in the minors, and I never thought that, but, you know, as I said, the A's have a way of doing this to me.
Don't take it personally. Our last email comes from Dan, and it says, guys, I love the new podcast. As a college baseball coach, these hour-and-a-half bullshit sessions help me get through long drives and flights and recruiting season. I wanted to ask a question about evaluating players. When I go to games, high school or summer ball, I evaluate the players almost in a vacuum, simply judging if they can play at the D1 level or not, regardless of what the level of the other players are on the field. But when I go to a camp or an event where there is a showcase portion, I tend to evaluate them in relation to each other. I don't use the 2-8 scale. I use a 1-5, and no matter how hard I try, I can't simply stick to the can they play for me or not scale. An average arm for that event may be totally different than an average arm at an event I'll be at next week, as he rates them as a 3. My question is, Jason, do you judge or evaluate players solely on the major league scale, or do you take the level of play around them into consideration? Thanks again for the great work, Dan. And by the way, Dan's team is in the NCAA tournament. I looked him up, and best of luck. So,
yeah, very cool. No, I do everything based on the major league, off of what, you know, off a major league scale, major league projection.
The reason I wanted to include this question was actually there was an interesting conversation. Aaron Fitt from Baseball America was the first one that brought it up, and I had a chance to talk to him a couple of weeks ago about this. But Tracy Smith, who's the head coach at Indiana, actually tells his coaching staff to recruit that they want to recruit guys that have at least one major league tool. One that they feel like can be an average major league tool. Now Smith went to scout school after his minor league career was finished, and before he got into college coaching. And that's part of what he tries to do. And Indiana's, you know, starting to build some program success. I mean, they've got new facilities there. They're actually hosting a regional this year, which is pretty cool. But that's part of his philosophy. And I thought that was a really interesting story from a college coach. Is, you know, obviously Dan's a situation where he's looking for guys that, you know, and we don't know, you know, there could be, you know, academic issues with it, you know, that you need to have a certain level academically, or you need, you know, whatever. And there's only so many scholarships, obviously, in college ball. But that's one of the focuses that they have at Indiana, is that they're interested in recruiting guys that have at least one major league tool, whether it be, you know, throwing arm, power, you know, hit tool, whatever it is. And I think that's a neat way to go about the recruiting process, and I think it ties back into what you were talking about with showcase ball. It's maybe a little easier to see at these showcases, you know, that show up than whether or not the guy has a field to play.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the idea a lot. I mean, when I've watched showcases before, it's been, you know, I've seen guys who make big throws, and I'm like, oh, well, that's a 6-arm or that's a 7-arm. And then I kind of have to remind myself of the context. It's like, yeah, but everybody else in this field has a 3-arm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I always try to, like, okay, if you put this player on a major league field, what would it look like compared to the surrounding talent? And that's obviously hard to do. That's just something that's how I try to envision it when I'm watching, you know, immature players.
Dan, thanks for the email. Thank you to everybody for the emails. We're going to talk a little bit about comments that Eric Wedge made and how it pertains to several young players and when the moment is right to send guys out or let them fight through their struggles. So it's a little bit, you know, tied into the email that we got on Arcia as well. That will be coming up when the Fringe Average podcast continues. The music again this week from the punk band Wolfface, the tribute to the movie Teen Wolf.
I think this is my all-time favorite band. Fuck the Beatles. This is great.
Just so you understand, we were talking, well, we took the quick break, we were talking about it. These guys actually go out on stage dressed as werewolves, wearing the basketball uniform from Teen Wolf. They're wearing the number
Beavers.
42 Beavers jersey with the socks pulled up high.
It's fan-fucking-tastic.
Man.
It's very special.
Absolutely. And again, you can follow them at facebook.com/pubesonmyface. So check them out. I can't wait. I'm excited for their full length album later this year. So
there's a picture of all four of them on a jungle gym. I just found it's fantastic.
That's That's awesome. And thanks to Matt who gave us got permission for us to be able to share the music and said this they are representative of the St. Petersburg music scene. So who knew that St. Petersburg was this cool?
I didn't know that.
The Dali Museum there is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That's a pretty neat place. But
it is.
All right. So earlier today, the Twitterverse lost their minds over this quote. I'm going to read the whole story from MLB.com, or at least this whole chunk of it. If you probably heard the news over the weekend, but Dustin Ackley was sent to AAA by the Mariners on Monday. You know, he's been just a mess the last 2 years offensively. Batting average is down to about 200. Wasn't getting on base. No slug. Nothing. And they were talking about the decision, and Eric Wedge was talking about how mentally, you know, Ackley was just ground down by the struggles, and it was time to send him out. And so here's the quote from the MLB.com article. I'm going to read both Wedge's quote and what was written. Wedge was talking about Ackley's demotion to AAA and his mental approach, and he intimated that Ackley might have been too concerned with pitch selectivity and high on-base percentage, leading to a one-liner that hit on one of baseball's most intriguing, quote, ongoing philosophical battles. It's the new generation. It's all this sabermetric stuff, for lack of a better term. You know what I mean? People who haven't played since they were 9 years old think they have it figured out. Gets in these kids' heads.
Why don't you lead off here? Because I loved what we talked about off air, and I want you just to go right back into that because that was pure sex.
I mean, Eric Wedge is right. I mean, if you're – here's the issue. You know, first of all, I don't think that this is an ongoing philosophical debate. This philosophical debate doesn't fucking exist. The numbers exist in every front office, as do the scouting reports. And it's a matter of how you use those numbers to help players to get better. But if it's a case where the Mariners feel like, and Ackley feels like, it's paralysis by analysis, that he's struggling because guys have been telling him that he needs to be more selective, well, then you know what? He's struggling because guys have been telling him to be more fucking selective. It's one thing to coach a player and to try and get them to improve their approach. It's another to change them who the fuck they are. And that's the problem. I mean, the Twitter losing its mind over this is I'm not surprised, but it's idiotic. I mean, what Wedge said is probably true. Now, he didn't need to take the dig at the idea of sabermetrics or some of the numbers guys, and probably some of the number guys in his own organization aren't real happy with what he said. But the fact is if that's what's getting in a player's head, if that's what's causing a player to struggle, then that's what's causing a player to struggle.
I agree, man. I think that, you know, people have this weird, you know, fascination with the walks. And, you know, we were talking about this off air about approach and about walks and about, like, the fundamental job is to obviously to score runs and to get on base. That's not a bad thing. I'm not shitting on walks. But you know, you got to hit the baseball or you're not going to be playing at the major league level. And if you don't hit the baseball, then pitchers are not going to work around you and you're not going to be able to get walks. You know, you have to hit, you know, that's the fundamental carrying tool of a position player. You have to hit the baseball. And if you have multiple approaches in your head, multiple philosophies, you're trying to do something that you're not, or you're trying to bend your game. I mean, baseball hitting is a comfort. It's a confident thing. And if you don't have either, then you're not going to hit, and you're not going to be around long.
No, and I think with I completely agree. I think that there's in Ackley's situation, I'm so mad I can't even organize my thoughts now. Because this
idea, I love it. Mark's mad.
I mean, this idea that he somehow, that Eric Wedge is somehow an idiot for saying this, is so fucking off base. I mean, it's just completely off base. If that's what's going on with this player, you can't go up and sit, you can't think about mechanics when you're hitting. You can't think about mechanics when you're pitching. You have to do. That's why you have side sessions. That's why you have work on the side. But if you're constantly getting in somebody's head to do something differently, and they're trying to change that at the major league level, it's nearly impossible. You know, think back to the movie Bull Durham, right? What he he talks about getting into the box, and he starts thinking, and he has to.
So you're thinking too much.
Right. Get out of your head, man. Get out of your fucking head, right? And he steps out of the box, and, okay, it's a funny moment. That's the key. That's what hitters do. That's what they need to do. They need to be processing what's coming the next pitch, not, gee, you know, I need to be more selective. Gee, I need to only be swinging at my pitch. Gee, I need to be getting on base more. The team needs me to get on base more. That's what causes you to press. That's what causes you to make mistakes. That's what causes you to not do the things that you're trying to do better.
Well, and, you know, as much as I don't think that his dig is helpful, and it isn't, you know, this is the kind of thing that keeps the two sides warring. It's what keeps the line, you know, between two sides.
There is no fucking war.
I'm saying it doesn't need to exist. He doesn't need to take a shot like this. I don't see the benefit of it.
No, there's only one side that's fighting, though. That's the thing. I'm with Eric Wedge. I'm with you on that, on what Eric Wedge said. Yeah, he doesn't need to take the dig. But the fact is that there's only one side that's fighting this fucking war, and they already fucking won. The numbers are part of the front office. It's part of every front office. Sam Miller had the great line last year that this isn't about stats versus scouts anymore. It's about stats versus, you know, versus mainstream media. That still may exist. But you know what? All the numbers are being used in the front office. And in fact, they might be being used too much in some instances because the players aren't able to process it. And if you can't communicate an idea, if you can't communicate the way that the players need to use the numbers, then you know what? They're not doing any good.
Yeah. And, you know, in taking what he said, as much as I disagree with the necessity of it, I don't necessarily disagree with it in one sense, and I'm not talking about people within the industry. I'm talking about a lot of people outside of the industry, and you know maybe they haven't played since they were 9 years old. But the main point is that they think that they have some sort of formula figured out, that they think that there's a certain way that baseball is played, and I usually fundamentally disagree with the way they go about thinking that. You know, when a team can go out and smash the shit out of a baseball, but they don't walk, so there's a problem. I don't understand that at all. I don't get it at all.
I mean, specifically, there was talk about that on Twitter yesterday, and with the Royals and facing Adam Wainwright, who's walked six guys all year. Six guys all season. You want to take more walks? Go ahead. Go up there with a passive approach. See what happens. See what happens.
Yeah, I didn't realize he'd walk that few. That's pretty impressive.
Six fucking guys. He's got like a 75-6 strikeout to walk ratio.
So you're saying people should go up there and try to swing the bat.
Jesus fucking Christ. I mean, and you know, we got into this discussion today, and there's a couple of things I want to get into on this because I think it extends to a longer discussion about players when they're struggling and when's the right time to send them back for a breather, especially when they're position players. And I'll give you some thoughts from a couple managers we talked to today about this because I think it's an interesting scenario. But this idea that you know, teams are teaching an approach that's what they call selectively aggressive, right? This is the new buzz phrase in approaches, selectively aggressive. I know what it means. I don't think it does a very good job of communicating what needs to happen. You know what I mean? I mean, you're talking about things that are diametrically opposed. And in fact, we were talking to John Farrell about this, and the Red Sox manager used to be a farm director. And he said, like so many things in baseball, he's like, you know, you've got two completely different terms that are, you know, should be at odds with each other that you're trying to work together. You know, I think the problem is that people hear patient and they think passive, but really that's the approach that you're trying to cultivate. You're trying to make players selective. You're trying to make them zone hitters, in essence, if you're calling them, you know, patient, selectively aggressive. What you want them to do is focus on a zone. And I think that more descriptive term, or being more descriptive in it than just saying, well, you know, we need you to be selectively aggressive, there's a better idea of communicating the idea than this controlled aggression or selective aggression or whatever it is that you're trying to implore guys to get into better counts to hit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's key. And that's what I mean when I mentioned that a minute ago. I think that that's a vital part of the approach that often gets lost at the expense of, you know, the crowning of walks. As, you know, it's not that I don't think any of these people think that getting on base is a bad thing. You know, I don't think that Eric Wedge is against, you know, hitters with high on-base percentage or guys who work walks, you know? I mean, but you have to hit the fucking baseball.
And Wedge worked in the Cleveland front office, which is one of the most, worked as the manager of the Cleveland Indians, which is one of the most progressive in terms of analysis.
Yeah, no question.
It was a flippant comment, and you're right. I mean, he took an unnecessary shot in it, but he's not wrong if that's what Ackley's problems were. And you know, we heard Jackson Rensick talking about this over the weekend with Jesus Montero. There's been a lot of talk in New York with Ike Davis about, you know, what they should do with him, as Davis is hitting, I think, .155 today, and what the Royals should do with Mike Moustakas, who's hitting in the 170s. When in your mind is the right time to send a guy back who's struggling, and what are the things you're looking for that makes you go, you know what, some time at AAA might help his confidence at that level, even though it's lesser pitching and sometimes it's tougher to make the actual mechanical adjustments?
And that's something that I think that we get to play experts on, but we're wrong because we don't have enough information to make these calls. You know, we're not with the player every day. We don't know if this is an attitude thing. We don't know if this is an adjustment thing. I mean, if you're just watching the swings, then maybe you can see something that a deficiency in his swing or the reason that he's not getting to a ball or certain pitches that he's struggling against. And you can make those type of determinations. But considering nobody who's writing about this works in player development, it's really hard for us to stand by something and say this is what needs to happen with the player. Now, we can speculate and we can make, you know, we can, you know, give opinion, and I have an opinion on all those guys that you just mentioned, and and I gave those before the Mariners front office came out, and then the Mariners front office came out and they gave, you know, more detailed explanations that made mine look like, oh, I was just throwing shit at a wall. And that's what I loved about the event, and that's what I love about the process, knowing that there's always something going on that we don't know about. And as much as we want to try to know everything, which I'm not sure why we really want to know everything, but when you look at a player, everything is very specific to that player. That player is going through something that's very specific to them. And it's not always as easy as, oh, he's struggling, let's send him down. Some things need to be worked on at the major league level. Some things have benefit going back to the minor league level when it comes to like confidence or perhaps a mechanical adjustment. The point is that there's always something going on and we just may not be privy to all of it. And, you know, It's easy for us to take the stand and say what needs to happen when a player needs to go down or a player doesn't need to go down or whatever, but you know, oftentimes we don't know what we're talking about.
Well, let's touch on these guys, at least some of the information we know. Montero, Jack Sorensic told us basically that he needed to get his confidence back because too much time had been wasting on trying to make him a catcher. I mean, that was in essence what it was.
Yeah, I like that answer too.
I mean, they think he's going to hit. He needs to go focus on being a hitter again. So that was the first one. Ackley, we obviously just heard, you know, we heard it from Eric Wedge. The approach got in his head. He needs to go work on it. He needs to get his confidence back in that regard. He's thinking too much. Just go and hit, crash. You know, Moustakas talked to Ned Yost today, and Ned catches. I don't think Ned Yost is a great manager when it comes to being a strategist. I think one of his great strengths with a young team is that he is a positive person. And I think that really helps to try and, you know, build up a clubhouse when it's going through tough times. When we asked him specifically about Moustakas, you know, he said, hey, Pops, take it easy. Jesus fucking Christ, I'm doing a podcast. There's not even – you're on the fourth floor of an apartment building. Knock it off.
You beat your dog on the air, we're probably going to lose some listeners.
No, I wouldn't do that. Dude, my dog is awesome.
I know.
Pops, settle. Come here. Settle. Okay? So here's what... He's literally jumping up at a window. He can't see out the window. Pops, how do you feel about Moustakas? I'll wait. It's okay. Thank you.
I'll wait for you, Pops. Go ahead.
No, it's all right.
Take the
spot.
No,
it's good to see that you listen. Embarrass me in front of all our friends like this. Okay. Is that it? Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, hi. How are you? It's good to see you. So Yost made a flippant comment about a week ago about it's not like we can exactly go out and get somebody else off the third base tree, right? You know, like somebody has planted third baseman in the yard and they've sprouted other third baseman. And specifically with Moustakas, that, you know, that he has some issues that he needs to work on, but he needs to work them out at the big league level. And what he talked about with him today is, you know, if his confidence was shot, he would send him down. But he says, but he's still extremely confident. Is he getting into counts where he's making mistakes on off-speed pitches? Yes. But is he still recognizing pitches well? Yeah, for the most part he is. He's missing the pitch that he needs to drive. And going down to AAA and having him face that level of competition isn't going to help him make the adjustment that he needs to at the big league level. And I think that goes back to what the email we got on Arcia said. You know, Ned Yost feels that way about Mike Moustakas, that you can send him out and try and make him go and do adjustments down there, but you aren't necessarily going to be able to make those adjustments because he could go down to Omaha and just – if he went down to Omaha and he took himself seriously right away, he would just put up monster numbers right now because he has so much more data in his head. And I think it goes, too, to how difficult it is to develop hitters and that, you know, Dayton Moore's getting killed for using the term, well, you know, 1,000 plate appearances give you an idea of where a guy is. I think when you talk to most hitting instructors, most development guys, they'll tell you 1,000 to 1,500 plate appearances is where you're at. Well, Moustakas and Hosmer are both in that range between 1,000 and 1,500. You know, maybe it's another full season before we get a better idea of where Mike Moustakas is and what kind of changes he can make. And obviously the Royals as an organization feel like he can work through his struggles right now at the big league level. Now maybe something with his confidence changes in a couple of weeks. You know, if he continues to struggle, maybe he starts getting frustrated. Maybe he starts taking bad at bats. Maybe all of that happens and then they send him out. It doesn't mean that they're not right now for leaving him in the big leagues to try and get his struggles figured out. And I think that that's part of it. This organization has this reputation of being idiots, and they are not. There are a lot of really good baseball people. They just aren't, I don't think, are as number-driven as some people would like them to be. And that's fine. It's not that they ignore the numbers. They just don't, they're not as, you know, externally number-heavy as some other organizations that people seem to love.
Yeah, and people love the Rangers, and they don't have an analytics department. Most people don't realize that.
But they understand the numbers.
Sure they do, but they're definitely more scouting heavy than people mm-hmm. even realize at all. And like at the Texas event, John Daniels came out and said, you know, I understand that we have a reputation for this, but we don't have an analytics department. We all happen to be well-rounded.
Well, and I think that that's what you see. I mean, while Tampa has a big analytics department, they also have a good scouting department.
Sure.
You know? I mean, it all goes hand in hand. You know, Ike Davis is the one that's interesting too because he's a guy that, you know, a year ago was hitting .170 in this same spot, and yet they haven't sent him out. There's been more ink written about Ike Davis being sent out than I think anybody else on the face of the earth because he plays in New York. And yet, you know, last year the guy ended up finishing with 32 home runs. At what point is he just a slow starter? You know?
Well, I mean, and there was something that Jack said at the event that really stuck with me, and he said, you don't want to give up on these guys too soon. Because you know the last thing you want to see is these guys coming back and 2 or 3 years down the line when you didn't give them enough opportunity and biting you on the ass.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I mean, know your players. If you believe in them, you know, continue to believe in them. Give them what they need to do to be successful. Whether that's going down to the AAA or you know struggling at the major league level, keeping them on a track, on a developmental track, so that one day they can reward you. I mean, I think that was a really interesting way of putting it, and it stuck with me.
I think there's a difference, too. I don't know if you think there is, between being lost and being frustrated. I think you can be lost at the plate and still understand what you're trying to accomplish or what you need to do to get better. Getting frustrated it completely defeats the purpose. You can't be frustrated as a hitter, because if you're frustrated by the results, then it starts to leak into the process, and then that's when you start making mistakes at the plate. That's when you really get down on yourself, and you start giving away at bats. And I know that's a term that kind of gets thrown around a lot. Not a whole lot of people, you know, we don't focus on it a whole lot. But there is a sake to be giving a professional at bat. You know, Pedro Alvarez has great power. He gives away a ton of at bats just by swinging at the first pitches that's coming out of the pitcher's hand. You know, now he has the power that he can kind of succeed. He's a good enough hitter that when he gets into good counts, he can do some damage. But there are some guys that when you start giving away at bat after at bat after at bat after at bat, the frustration builds and you need to send that guy out. And that's what I think is one of the other parts of this, is that it's not just about results, it's about the approach, and you know, we touched on this last week, and the process to getting to those results that are important.
Right. I mean, look at Josh Hamilton. I mean, he happens to be a freak, but he gives away a ton of at-bats.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a ton.
How many bats a night do you think he gives? He gives away at least one a night, right?
I think he goes up to the plate not giving a shit at least once.
Do you think it's that he doesn't give a shit, or he's like, I'm getting a fastball here, and he doesn't get it, and he's like, well, fuck it, I'm going to get it here, and he doesn't get it again, and then the next thing you know, he's well, that's 0-2, I got a battle, and then he's gone.
Or he thinks, I want a fastball here, and he gets a changeup, and he just says, fuck it, I'm going to roll over it. <You know? laughs> So that's what I kind of see not giving a shit, because it's like, okay, that's a changeup? Yeah, it's not a fastball? Yeah, it's not what I wanted? Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and swing anyway, fuck it. I'm Josh Hamilton, because sometimes I can turn this into a home run. That's the problem with being a Superman. That you always think you're Superman.
I mean, isn't that the problem?
You're not.
Isn't that the problem with guys who have big hit tools and may not need the approach? They get such great. I was actually listening to Hawk Harrelson talk about this with Starlin Castro last night, talking about his plate coverage. And he's like, the problem is you end up start thinking that you can hit everything, and then you do. And the problem is that you're not hitting the pitches that you need to drive.
Well, that's Josh Vitter's problem.
Yeah.
That was always his problem. He was a tremendous bat speed. I mean, just tremendous raw hit tool. But he thought he could hit everything. And, you know, there aren't many Vladimir Guerreros out there who can hit balls that bounce.
All right. So that's it for us, I think, right? We've now covered everything we need to. What are you doing this week? What do you have going on? You got some baseball going on?
I got some baseball going on.
Okay. That sounds good. I've got some baseball going on. I have to reconnect with the wife after being on the road for 10 days. So,
oh, yeah, of course.
So probably hang out a little bit. I really want to go see, because it's only in town through Thursday, documentary on Levon Helm.
Oh, what a special talent.
Levon is my, like, he's like my spirit animal. I went up twice to Midnight Rambles at his place. My credential for games is on a Levon Helm band lanyard.
I noticed that your lanyard is Levon Helm.
Yeah, I loved Levon, and so I really want to go see this movie while it's here, because it's supposed to be great. So I've got a couple more nights to do it. I might do it on Wednesday, but
that sounds great.
Other than that, it's regionals for baseball this weekend, and Friday I'm going to be just watching college baseball for like 24 hours probably. So.
The only problem with college baseball on ESPN is that occasionally they show Sweet Tea Rogers, and it's just not – I don't want to see that on my television.
At least they get his front, you know.
I know. His back is a problem.
Oh, fuck. I can't even tell you how much I hate Jason Cole right now.
For sending you the Kendall's ass crack.
Every fucking time. Ben Ford from Perfect Game tweeted out the picture again last night. I'm like, seriously, every time you do that, Cole gets more powerful. It's not cool. I don't need to see Kendall's ass crack, that's for sure.
Oh, no, I don't even want to see Kendall.
I'm going to get to spend like 2 weeks with Kendall.
Oh, my God.
I know. I need a buffer. You want to come to Omaha?
You're going to need to go to detox afterwards. Wear an outbreak suit or something while you're here.
Why, from all the sweet tea that I'm going to have to ingest?
All the sweet tea that's going to sweat out of his pores. SEC pride.
He does wear his class ring, so.
No, he's a fool.
All right. Enjoy the music from Wolfface. We are out of here. We'll do it again next week. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Or don't. I mean, I don't fucking care.
I was already checked out. Sorry.
Slack.
Generation, but it ended on my face through the reflection. generation. I was hoping it would pass you by.
Well, it didn't pass me by. We landed on my face.
Get a dog back!